This is Paul Kangas on radio station KPOO, and this is Reality Sandwich, a continuing investigation into the forces behind the assassination of John Kennedy. And on the line with me this morning, I have from Florida a man named Lars Hansen, who's an expert and investigator on the Kennedy assassination. Good morning, Lars.
Good morning, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
I should probably correct you just somewhat there. I really don't consider myself as an expert, maybe a little bit further down the road, but
how about a member of the
jury that's entertaining the evidence as to who killed John Kennedy?
Absolutely, and trying most determinedly to surface as much more evidence as possible. I regard myself pretty much as the second generation of researchers who have been very, very fortunate to make use of the work of other groundbreaking pioneers like Bob Groden and Fletcher Prouty and Sylvia Mayer and so forth to build upon the information that they've been able to bring out and then start putting more of the pieces together.
And what recently you produced a film that you now released, and then it became a problem. You want to talk about that?
Well, actually, no, I'd rather not, Paul, but since you brought it up, let me clarify that fairly quickly, if possible.
Many people in this area have seen that version of the Zapruder film, and it would be nice if you could clarify it.
Absolutely, and I appreciate the opportunity, Paul. As a matter of fact, it became such a serious matter, about a year and a half ago, by the time I became aware of just what had happened. This 5-minute videotape regarding what we refer to as the Greer theory, the theory that the driver of the vehicle, the Secret Service agent William Greer, actually turned around and fired some sort of handgun at John F. Kennedy, inflicting the fatal blow. I want to go on record right at the outset here today in saying that I certainly do not believe that that happened. I believe that it did not happen at all, that in fact William Greer did turn around twice to look back at the president, and in fact he did step on the brakes and brought the presidential limousine almost to a complete halt after Kennedy had been shot in the throat. But I personally, and there are many, many other people who've done very hard research on this, do not believe that he had any sort of weapon in his hand, however much the film might look like it. However, having said that, the video, which I threw together very hastily 4 years ago, Paul, in California, after having met with a couple of other researchers who had been invested 15 years into that theory, and I believe to this day are probably still convinced that's what happened. I had looked over much of their evidence. As a matter of fact, two of these men, Perry Adams and Ron Newcomb, had put together a 500-page manuscript with many, many footnotes throughout the piece, which it was never published formally, but it was available in manuscript form, I think almost 15 years ago, in support of this particular theory. So it wasn't a frivolous effort. It wasn't any kind of effort at that point
It was a serious attempt to investigate the Zapruder film and examine it to see if there was any evidence indicating that the driver was involved, and now you believe that the driver was not involved. I believe that also.
Yes. And I should clarify that even further, Paul. I actually do believe that William Greer was involved in the conspiracy. I think his actions were extremely suspicious.
Slowing the car down?
Slowing the car down.
I believe the reason he did that is because Sheriff Curry, the Dallas sheriff who was leading the motorcade and who misled the motorcade, made the wrong right turn onto Houston, and then the wrong left turn onto Elm Street, was actually probably a member of the conspiracy. And Greer might have, but I think Greer was sucked into it.
It's possible. I mean, I really wouldn't want to try to argue that case definitively today, but I think for a man who is a 35-year veteran of the Secret Service and had been a wheelman for years, after he heard that first shot and after he had already turned around once to look at the president, no matter who was in front of him, he should have been driving the car right over the top of them. So, there was a Dr. Alvarez who claimed that it was an instinctive reaction because he'd heard a siren, and so he was this was actually in the Warren Commission testimony, that he instinctively stepped on the brake and was preparing to pull over, which is absolutely ludicrous, you know, like the rest of the Warren Commission testimony. But the point I want to make, at least to try to summarize this now, and then we can go further into it if you'd like, but the point was that I had very hastily thrown this videotape together, mainly to preserve the rather poor copy of the Zapruder film that this person had. He had had it for many years. It was, we figured at best, probably a fourth-generation copy that he had obtained from a guy who bootlegged them up in Toronto. I'm sure some of your listeners might be familiar with that.
Right.
And so we transferred it over to 3/4-inch video and then edited it and then transferred it again onto 3/4-inch and then down to 1/2-inch. So at best, it was a seventh-generation copy, so which, you know, anybody who's done any sort of video copying knows that each time you do it, you get very serious degradation of the film quality or the video quality.
Right.
So consequently, those images really couldn't prove anything. The giant mistake that I made, for which I have taken responsibility publicly on many occasions, on television, on radio, in print, you name it, Paul, is that in my haste to throw this thing together, I literally did the final editing in about 45 minutes in order to use the video to make a presentation to some financial backers who were considering putting the money up to do a real complete investigation of that angle. And I should add, Paul, I'm sure you're quite familiar, also regarding the bullet slug that ended up on the opposite side of Elm Street from where Zapruder was. I'm sure you're familiar. A rather large caliber slug surrounded by what appeared to be bits of brain tissue, with two police officers looking on, and another man who is claimed to have been an FBI agent comes by, leans over, looks at it, picks it up, puts it in his pocket, and walks away. And that entire sequence was photographed, and yet it has never been addressed officially in any of the investigations.
Right, that's part of the evidence that's buried in the National Archives till 2029.
Except that the photographs are extant. They certainly can be obtained. Very clear photographs and close-ups of that particular slug. So our question was, if Greer did not fire a weapon, if that reflection that appears to be a weapon in his hand was not a weapon, if as Robert Groden and numerous other very respected researchers argue that it was, in fact, the reflection off the top of Agent Kellerman, Roy Kellerman's head, in the front seat of the car.
Right.
Then where did that bullet slug on the opposite side of Elm Street come from? So that was basically the direction I was trying to go. The mistake that I made, Paul, was that I had entrusted a copy, and I, by the way, I never released it. I want to emphasize that. I never released that videotape for public distribution at all. It was never intended to be shown publicly at all. It was strictly a research tape. I personally gave, I think, a total of four copies to very close and trusted friends. And John Lear, the famous Lear jet family, and he's big in the UFO field these days, had asked me where he could get a copy, and I told him that he could get one from the studio where I put it together. I didn't even give one to him. I certainly did not give one to this man, Bill Cooper. He obtained his copy from John Lear. But these men, either independently or jointly, then decided that this would be a wonderful thing to go out and promote and distribute. And I think, I truly believe in both cases, whether they're working independently or jointly, Paul, I believe that it was a very, very deliberate effort not only to disinform the public, but also to try to discredit me because of the work that I was doing at that time with Colonel Bo Greitz and involving very high-level U.S. government officials' involvement in very large-scale heroin and cocaine smuggling.
You know, they did a mass distribution of that tape. I mean, it was like they did a saturation bombing of the United States with that false videotape, and it was just incredible, the effect. People call me all the time asking about it, and I can't believe the effect nationwide that videotape had. It's everywhere.
Well, you know, when I first began to hear about this, because I had been working over in Las Vegas, as I mentioned, with Bo Greitz, I collaborated with him in the writing. I did a lot of background research in the writing of his two books, I don't know if your audience is familiar with him. It's kind of sad he's running for president, and still a few people have heard of him, but he was the most decorated Green Beret in history, the man that they made the movies Rambo and Uncommon Valor and
right.
Missing in Action about.
That's one of the next issues on the next portion of the program.
Okay, well, good. So you can go into more detail. But at any rate, I was very heavily involved in that, and when I got back to California, I wasn't aware that this transaction, if you will, had taken place between Lear and Cooper at all until several months later. And by the time I found out what had happened and confronted Cooper on the phone, in person, on radio, and tried to do it on TV, but at the last minute he backed out of the program. Have tried everything I can do to try to clarify this matter, but in fact he did. He has distributed hundreds or probably thousands at this point, and yet the last time I spoke to Cooper and was threatening a lawsuit to force him to cease and desist, he insisted that he didn't have enough money, and he actually wrote in his book, which the title was even plagiarized, Behold a Pale Horse. He plagiarized the title and a lot of the contents from numerous other sources, including myself. He even admits in there that he didn't have enough money to take my narration off. I'd insisted that he do that. I said, if you want to show a copy of the Zapruder film, I can't stop you, but I would like you to take my narration off because it's simply not correct. And I believe it was actually done not only maliciously but very purposely to disinform and confuse people.
Yeah,
and I feel real badly about it, Paul. It's someone called in once on a radio program and said that'll haunt me to my grave, and that is true. But
I don't think so. I think as long as we keep talking about it and clarifying it this way, I think that what'll happen is that eventually Cooper will be exposed for whoever he is, and I suppose when we get the files out of the National Archive, we'll find Cooper's name amongst
I don't know. That might be stretching a little bit. I really don't think he was that important a personage then or now, frankly. And what's incredible about Cooper, and I don't want to, you know, skirt slander here, but what's incredible about the man, given what is known about his actual background and what he's been doing since he's gone public with all this, is that he just doesn't hold up. He has switched his story. He's completely reversed himself countless times, documented times on audio tape, videotape,
right.
etc.
Actually, what we're trying to do with the program is examine the evidence.
Sure.
And see if we can find more evidence directly sorting out.
Regarding the assassination
right,
itself.
Of John Kennedy, Dr. King, and Robert
Absolutely.
Kennedy.
Absolutely. Well, that obviously is the most important effort, and if I digressed a little bit there relative to Cooper, it's just to try to emphasize the fact that the work of a number of very, very serious and very dedicated and very painstaking researchers, such as Grodin and myself and a number of others that Cooper has gone, whose work he's appropriated, has just tended to really confuse people and turn it into such a mishmash. And
well, here's one of the situations, though. If you've ever sat on a jury trial, that's what happens before a jury, that the prosecution presents their case, the defense presents their case, and it becomes confusing because both sides tell totally different stories, and so the jury has to sort it out. And it's the same situation with what's going on in this country now. It's the longest ongoing investigation and jury trial in the history of this country, uncovering who actually killed the president. And so we don't want to encourage confusion, but we do want to have as many witnesses testify as possible before the jury, which is the whole population of the United States.
Absolutely. Well, needless to say, Paul, I'm sure you've been discussing this issue a number of times previously, and the film that Oliver Stone put together, which is certainly not perfect and it's not flawless, but it is absolutely excellent, nevertheless, in examining many of those aspects of the events that happened both before and after the assassination that have been either completely stifled or suppressed from public scrutiny. And as people will discover very soon, because of material that we're going to be releasing, and I say we, primarily myself through Paragon Research, but also in a couple books that I'm working on at the present time.
If people would like to contact you, can you give your address out?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's Paragon Research at P.O. Box 981 in Orlando, Florida, 32802. This list stays strictly on my computer. It is not going anywhere else but right here, and I will tell anyone listening I'll be happy to send them out a free catalog of material. I have a tremendous amount of material that I publish regarding the Kennedy assassination, which is not widely known. I am working right now with first-hand sources to the events in Dallas. That's why I'm in Florida. I'm actually a California boy myself, Paul, and I've been fortunate to spend quite a bit of time up in your fair city. But I'm down here specifically to dig into the Miami nexus of the Kennedy assassination, and it has yielded tremendous revelations.
I can imagine. I envy your position.
I might add also that if people are interested in ordering the catalog or a package that I have put together, they're welcome to call me. If you want the catalog, please leave your address. You can call 800-841-9411. I'll be happy to send you out the free catalog and additional material. If you'd like to order the package, which I call Profiles in Conspiracy, which is extremely packed with information, including Mae Brussels' famous article on the Nazi connections to the assassination, as well as the Torbett document. That package is $25 plus $3 shipping. I've mailed out hundreds and hundreds of these over the last few months. I haven't had any return.
Good. Well, thank you for your call. We really appreciate it. We're going to continue the program now with an examination of the bankers involved in the assassination.
Oh, that should be fascinating.
The money system. And thank you for your call.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate the time.
Okay.
Keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Sure, you're right, and you know that you're right on target here at Hicks Target. My name is Mark Anton, and these are the Nihilists. On my left, a man the band likes to call the saxophone player. Only been playing saxophone for 3 weeks. Isn't that amazing? And on my right, on a work release program from San Bruno County Jail, on Leopard Street Johnson, the one.
With the continuing investigation of who killed President Kennedy, Dr. King, and Robert Kennedy. This is Paul Kangas, and with me today is a person that I met who has a great understanding of the money that's in your pocket. And if you want to participate in this program, the money aspect of it is that the money that's in your pocket is actually owned by a private banking system, and you're paying interest on it. You may not be aware of that, but if you take a dollar bill or a $5 bill out of your pocket and take a look at it, you'll notice at the top of the bill, it
It says Federal Reserve.
Right, it says Federal Reserve. And with me today is Mike Marino, who I consider an expert on how our money is being used to rip us off, how our money is being used to, just like, you know, those credit cards with the 18% interest, 18% interest on a credit card. Well, the interest we pay on our money is just ripping off this country at a tremendous rate. And Mike, could you please explain to us how come on the top of the bill it says Federal Reserve now, and who is this secret Federal Reserve?
Well, the Federal Reserve was started in 1913 by a group of bankers who secretly put together this plan to take control of the currency of the nation. Just prior to this, they were trying to put through the Aldrich plan, but that didn't gain wide acceptance, and the bankers thought of a better name and came up with the Federal Reserve. The plan was pushed through Congress just before Christmas, when most of the congressmen had already taken recess for the holiday.
In 1913.
When the general public finally heard about it, they didn't suspect that anything was awry, because the name of it was Federal. And of course, everybody just figured, well, Federal must mean the federal government. But in fact, the Federal Reserve is a private banking corporation that makes a profit. It's a profit-making corporation, and has been since its inception.
So Kennedy discovered that our money is being printed by this private bank, and that we're being gouged outrageous interest.
Yes.
For the money that's in our pocket.
That's right.
And then Kennedy decided to do something. What did he do?
That's right. June the 4th, 1963, President Kennedy signed Executive Order 11.110, which authorized the printing of United States notes. This was his attempt to begin to dismantle the Federal Reserve and create United States currency on which there'd be no debt. He started printing $5 bills and $2 bills. And after he was killed, the printing stopped, and many of these bills were withdrawn from circulation. For those who look into this very, very carefully, you will find that there were a couple hundred thousand of these bills printed after 1963, but for all intents and purposes, the printing was stopped after President Kennedy was killed, and the plan to abolish the Federal Reserve ended.
So it's that's an angle, an angle that should be investigated to understand the forces behind the killing of Kennedy. In other words, Kennedy angered these bankers who were making billions doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were angry at Kennedy for cutting them out of the pig trough.
That's right. In fact, in 1983, $111 billion was given to the Federal Reserve. Bo Greitz has said that last year, $300 billion was given to the Federal Reserve as interest payments on the debt. If we consider the amount of money that's needed to run the country for all the basic human needs, and then consider how much is being given to the bankers annually, it's staggering.
Well, number-wise, how does that compare to our defense budget? $300 billion, what do we spend on defense?
Probably $400 billion as a guess. So $300 billion is a considerable. It's almost as much as we spend on defense.
So if we were to eliminate this Federal Reserve budget of $300 billion, we'd be able to fund our schools, fund our hospitals, build housing for people.
Everything you want, you could have if we didn't have the Federal Reserve.
And all it takes is one stroke of the pen.
That's right. It might take a little bit more than one stroke of the pen, because first of all, people have to be aware of the fact that this private banking system is in existence. And then from there, we can begin to demand that our representatives do something about it. In this regard, about 3 years ago, I wrote a letter to my Congresswoman, Barbara Boxer, and I informed her that there was a bill before the Congress to audit the Federal Reserve, which was going to be a first. It seems that the General Accounting Office, which is the Congressional Auditing Agency, has not ever audited the Federal Reserve System.
Sort of like the CIA's never been audited either.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, right. They don't. There's Congress is not allowed to look into the budget of the CIA. For instance, one year, some congressional staffer asked how many rolls of toilet paper the CIA used. Mm. The theory was that if we could get a simple question like that answered, how many rolls of toilet paper the CIA uses, we'd know, we could guesstimate how many rolls of toilet paper per person, and then know how many people there are employed by the CIA, but the CIA would not even reveal how many rolls of toilet paper they use to wipe out their enemies, or whatever it is they wipe out.
The black budget, money that is allocated to the secret police that's unaccounted for, certainly is amazing. But what I was saying about Barbara Boxer, Congresswoman, is that when I wrote this letter to her and asked her to co-sponsor the bill to audit the Federal Reserve, and also to look into my allegation that it was a private corporation, she responded that, in fact, according to her, for all intents and purposes, because the president appoints the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, that it is part of the government. And she assured me that the agency or the bank had been audited many times, and she sent me a copy of their annual report. Well, I thought that I was wrong. So after some time, I did some more research, and I discovered that, in fact, she was wrong. And first of all, the audits that had been conducted were done internally. They were not done by the General Accounting Office. And also, in every other regard, beyond the fact that the President appoints the Board of Governors, it is, in fact, a private banking corporation that makes a profit on the people every year. But you know, Paul, even further than that, what's so astounding about the Federal Reserve is this unbelievable thing that they can do. That is, they can make money from nothing. In fact, one of the banking chairmen, Wright Patman, several years ago, went to the Federal Reserve and wanted to find out where the reserves were. It found out there were no reserves to begin with. And then he discovered that when the government wants to borrow money from the Federal Reserve, it creates it out of nothing. And we're paying interest on
the paper.
On the paper that's created out of nothing. And this is what the big bankers in Europe wanted to achieve several hundred years ago, and they did achieve. They managed to get control of the countries of Europe through their banks. And the Rothschilds, one of them at one point said he didn't really care who ran the country as long as he could control the money. And it seems that when the colonists, when the pioneers came here to the U.S., one of the things that they were most upset about at the early years, a couple hundred years ago, was that the English were in control of the currency.
This is a secret. We're not supposed to be discussing this stuff on the air. You're not supposed to know that the bankers control the government.
You're absolutely right.
Don't let anybody know. If you're listening to this, plug your ears. Please don't let anybody know what's going on.
You're absolutely right, Paul. This is really heavy stuff when you consider it. When the what we call the Pilgrims were here, they were arguing with the English that they wanted to be able to control their own money. But the English were controlling the currency. And in fact, that's what prompted the revolt against the British. In fact, the first colony that really revolted was Massachusetts, when they minted a pine tree shilling, which was form of currency printed or minted, it was a coin, here in the U.S. Well, the British confiscated all the coins they could, and they put pressure on the colonists. In fact, the British also brought into this country counterfeit money to devalue what script was being printed by some of the colonists and bankers in their attempt to provide their own currency. And that was the primary reason why the colonists revolted, was to have their own money.
Uh-huh. Well, I understand that the members of the Federal Reserve are mostly of British descent.
Well, I don't know if it's most of them, but some of them certainly are. We know that there are several big banking families that control the Federal Reserve, and we believe the Bank of England owns some of the stock as well. So we could extrapolate from that and figure that the wealthiest people in England are in on it.
Now, my understanding of the major reasons why Kennedy was killed was he cut off the air cover for the invasion of Cuba, and he was withdrawing troops from Vietnam, and then that he cut off the Federal Reserve from its slush fund, and so forced the bankers to consider having to get a job.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly Oliver Stone has pointed out that in addition, the idea of trying to stop the war in Vietnam was one of the big motives. At the end of the movie, he states that there was some $200 billion spent in Vietnam. However, if you consider the amount of money that's gone to the Federal Reserve bankers over the years, $200 billion really isn't very much. For example, if you consider between 1960 and 1990, at an average, let's say, of $100 billion per year, over 10 years you'd have $1,000 billion. Over 30 years you'd have $3,000 billion, or $3 trillion.
I think we should talk to Barbara Boxer a little bit more and educate her. To anybody that's listening to this program and would have an interest in getting more money for the schools, or more money for our hospitals, or more money for all the services we need to provide in society, please write to me, Paul Kangas, or call me. My address is P.O. Box 422-644, San Francisco 94142, or you can call me at my office, 415-897-0153. And what I would like to do is start a petition to Barbara Boxer specifically, since she's not only unaware but really misinformed on this issue, and we need to put pressure on her, because if she doesn't know where most of the money's going, it's her job to know, and we're going to have to correct her so that when she goes to represent us in Congress, she can stand on the floor of Congress and say, look here, gentlemen, you've got to take your hands out of the pockets of my constituents in San Francisco, because they're tired of paying $300 billion a year interest on the money that's in their pocket. Mm-hmm. And we need that money for our schools, and we need that money for our communities. Mm-hmm. So if you out in the listening audience hearing this, please write or give me a call, and we'll go visit Barbara Boxer after we write her a letter and send her some petitions and give her adequate, fair notice that she's misinformed and that she has to correct her view of who these Federal Reserve folks are and where our money is going.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Boxer now, this year, did co-sponsor a bill to audit the Federal Reserve. So that's a good step in the right direction. But really, the ultimate goal is to abolish the Federal Reserve. And in order to do that, we have to make people aware of the fact that what President Kennedy was doing with the printing of the United States notes was really what needs to be done. In 1963, again, he printed United States notes. And at the top of the bill, the very top, in fine print, it said United States note. If you look at any bill you have in your pocket today, it'll say Federal Reserve note. That money is private bank money. And the name itself is, in fact, misleading, deceitful, and one could say fraudulent, because it's not part of the federal government. There are many people who are becoming aware of this. Many people are speaking about it around the country, and the knowledge is gaining acceptance, and it's spreading quickly. So as we begin to protest and make our views known, instead of demanding health care, instead of demanding schools and demanding other things, if we focus on the Federal Reserve, that would then give us the money to do these other things. So we should get to the bottom of the problem. The bottom
right.
of the problem
Very
is
good.
The money. And most people, I'm sure, are aware that the money is the crunch. That's where the stick is. And if we can abolish the Federal Reserve, we'll have all the money we need to do all the amazing things that can be done in this country. And it's going to take some doing, because these Federal Reserve bankers are very powerful, and they don't want the public to know about this, and they most certainly don't want to have their siphon stopped. Keep this in mind as you go along, and if you want to get information about it, one of the best people to read is Eustace Mullins. He has a book titled The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. Mr. Mullins at times tends to be a bit of a racist, not so much against blacks, but against Jews at times. But he does have a lot of information, and we have to learn how to weed through and sift through to get the good stuff. He's at the Bankers Research Institute at P.O. Box 1105, Staunton, Virginia. It's S-T-A-U-N-T-O-N, Virginia, 24401. The Bankers Research Institute, P.O. Box 1105, Staunton, Virginia, 24401. Also, there's another excellent publication on this subject. It's put out by the Committee to Restore the Constitution in Colorado. And they write an excellent book titled The Most Secret Science. And the subtitle is The Most Secret Knowledge, a Science Which Outdates History, is the Science of Control Over People, Governments and Civilizations. The foundation of this ultimate discipline is the control of wealth, the money. This book is chock full of excellent information, and you can reach them at P.O. Box 986 at Fort Collins, Colorado, 80522. That's the Betsy Ross Press at P.O. Box 986, Fort Collins, Colorado, 80522.
Okay, we're going to take a moment's rest for our ears here with some great music from the San Francisco Mime Crew.
Can you guess just who we are? One part business, one part war. We own the weapons, banks, and land. Call us Armageddon Man. There is less, but we want more. So we take it from the poor. You can't stop us, no one can, because we're Armageddon Man. Karl Marx predicted our demise, but it's on crisis that we thrive. Find a new market or a war will do, and we'll see our historic mission.
All right, we're back with Mike Marino and Paul Kangas. This is Reality Sandwich here on radio station KPOO in San Francisco on another beautiful San Francisco foggy, rainy day. Mike Marino and I co-founded a print shop process. We printed up a petition, and on the top of the petition, there's a $5 bill. So in a way, we're printing these old Kennedy $5 bills, which say U.S. notes on the top. to remind people of what a free money looked like in a free society once upon a time back in the days of Camelot, 1963, when we were approaching the days, the dawning of Aquarius. We were approaching a world peace situation, a free money situation, trade with the Russians instead of war with the Russians, peace with Cuba.
Exploration of space.
Right. Right. Kennedy was the one that launched us into exploration of space. And in fact, you're a co-founder of Space Energy, I believe.
Space Energy Association, yes.
Okay. So, I mean, many of us, I guess, are children of the Kennedy error, the Kennedy rise, and it arose in a way that inspired our dreams. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be able to live this age of Aquarius, and it was cut short by six assassins bullets in Dallas, Texas, representing the six ruling class families, I guess, the Morgans, the Mellons, the DuPonts, the Rockefellers, the Giannini's, and
the big wealth behind the Federal Reserve.
It seems like each one of the families planted one bullet in Kennedy's skull that day. You know, they shot him about six times. There were six shots on the tape, and it's sort of interesting symbol there, the six big banking families fired six shots and wiped out the potential for peace. It's like today the U.S. is planning the reinvasion of Cuba at a time when most of the world wants peace, because we need peace to be able to feed our families, educate our kids, and just enjoy life much better. Now we have to conduct this intense investigation to understand this period in history that resulted in a war that murdered not only John Kennedy, but millions of Vietnamese and thousands of young Americans who lost their lives in this terrible, bloody period in world history, set off by the murder of one person. It's astounding that one person's murder can change history so much, but there's examples of it previously. Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And
the president's a very powerful person and has the say in a lot of things, and certainly his removal made it possible to do a lot of things that the permanent war economy really wanted to do. Professor Melman, Seymour Melman, wrote a book titled The Permanent War Economy. He's a professor of industrial engineering at Columbia University. He's been here in the Bay Area several times, and he's pointed out that we are spending so much money on military appropriations that we can't fund human need programs. This is the real problem today. While some of the big corporations continue to thrive off of the production of weapons systems, the vast majority of the public goes hungry. And the only way this will stop is if enough of the ordinary people begin to put pressure on their representatives to begin to look at the real basis of the money. And that means the Federal Reserve, and that means the war budget. And there has to be an absolute demand that this stop, and that there be a focus on the human needs of the people. I encourage all of you to contact your congresspeople and question them and encourage them to abolish the Federal Reserve. We must go beyond an order to the Federal Reserve. It must be abolished, and that money that's given to them must be given to the people for all the things that are so desperately needed.
Right. If people would like to participate in this process, we have a petition which calls for reopening the investigation into the assassination of John Kennedy, the release of the Kennedy files, and especially the Watergate tapes. And on the back of the petition, it's got this very concise, short article explaining how the Federal Reserve is ripping us off. So it's the first step we've taken to call for the abolition of the Federal Reserve, to reveal to people the insidious nature of this parasite that is on our throat, bleeding us to death. I mean, we've got the military bleeding us to death. We've got the Federal Reserve bleeding us to death, and we've got the drug epidemic bleeding us to death, which is, in some ways, the AIDS epidemic is part of the drug epidemic. And
we're in deep trouble, Paul. You know,
yeah, this country is in deep trouble.
When I think about what's happening out there around us, it's frightening, really. I remember back in the 60s and the 70s, and I didn't have any of this knowledge at that time. In fact, just a few years ago, not even a few, just 2 years ago, I heard about Bo Greitz, who Lars Hansen was just referring to. And I opposed the Vietnam War very vigorously at that time. And when I heard that Bo Greitz was the most decorated soldier there in Vietnam, it didn't carry a lot of weight with me. But I heard that he did have a videotape that was supposed to be fascinating, and after many weeks I did receive it, and when I saw it, the story was unbelievable. Here was this decorated soldier going back to Southeast Asia looking for prisoners of war, and when he got there, he met the head man in Burma, who explained to him that he had no prisoners of war. I'd like to know some other information. And that information was that this leader in Burma was dealing with top United States military and secret police officials from the United States all during the Vietnam War. And what was he doing but selling them his cash crop, which is, to this day, opium and heroin. And
they made a movie about it, Air America.
Uh-huh, yes.
About the CIA smuggling of heroin back into this country in order to poison the population.
Yes, it's unbelievable to consider that this would happen. And Bo Greitz was in shock when he heard this. In fact, when he came back to the United States, he gave this information to his contact in Washington, who said he would take it to the White House. A few days later, he told Greitz that there was no interest in this at the White House. And Bo Greitz said, "What?" And the guy repeated himself, saying that there was no interest in it at the White House. And he said, "Furthermore, I'd suggest that you destroy any documents you have and forget everything you've seen." Bo Greitz was in shock. He couldn't believe that he was hearing this from his contact, who had taken the information right to the White House. This was just a few years ago. Bo Greitz wouldn't be quiet. So he continued talking about it, and then they prosecuted him for misusing his passport, which was a phony charge. The former attorney general of the state of Nevada heard about it, took the case for free, got the charges dropped. Bo Greitz picked up two of his buddies in a video camera, went back to Burma, made a videotape about the whole thing, and that's what I saw a couple years ago. And the conversation has continued, and it's mind-boggling to consider this. But don't think you're alone. There are people who are fighting this right now. Bo Greitz is running for president, although the general public doesn't know it, and you won't find it in the Chronicle or the Examiner. But if you contact Bo Greitz in Nevada at the Center for Action, I just don't happen to have his address with me, but you could ask Lars Hansen about it.
Is it in that book?
It might be, yes. Good thinking, Paul.
Okay. I'm going to try and find a guest. If there's anybody in the listening audience that is active around the AIDS issue and fighting for more funding for AIDS, I'm going to try and find a speaker who knows about the Federal Reserve and is fighting for more money for AIDS, because it seems to me that we need that money from the Federal Reserve. We got 2 minutes.
2 minutes, very quickly. For Bo Greitz, you can get more information from Lazarus Publishing Company. Lazarus, L-A-Z-A-R-U-S, P.O. Box 472, HCR-31, Sandy Valley, Nevada, 89019. Again, that's Lazarus Publishing, Box 472, HCR-31, Sandy Valley, Nevada, 89019. And Paul, if we have another half a minute, do we, for information about AIDS? Well, we can talk about that later.
We'll do that next week. Okay. And now it's music time. Are we on music?
Hour?
Yeah.
We're over now?
Yeah, give me the information you had, Mike, on the AIDS contact.
Well, the AIDS contact you can get through Bogue Rights. Bogue Rights had a conference 2 years ago in Las Vegas at which was Dr. Robert Strecker, an outspoken medical doctor, also a PhD, who has some astounding information on AIDS, suggesting very strongly that it was man-made and didn't happen naturally. Through Bogue Rights, you can
What I was thinking of more of is the funding angle.
Well, the funding, that's a good question.
In other words, take the money from the Federal Reserve.
Yes, certainly, that's a good idea. Incidentally, Paul, speaking of funding, we need some funding. We need an office, we need a secretary, we need a copy machine. If there are any very wealthy people in our audience, when I say very wealthy, if you have $100,000 in the bank and you could afford to spend a few dollars, or if you have $1 million in the bank, please get in touch with Paul Kangas. We could certainly use some help.
Thank you. And it's music time. Thank you.
San Francisco
89.5 on your FM dial.